listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As we've been reporting this week, Russia's foreign ministry is making a diplomatic offensive throughout the Middle East, with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov making a tour of the Persian Gulf area. On Wednesday, he visited the United Arab Emirates, and he and Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who is the foreign minister of the UAE, held a joint press conference after they met.
Well, I'm happy to welcome the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation, Sergei Lavrov. This is a great opportunity to discuss the development of our bilateral relations for the several years. Last week, so the coming into force, the cancellation of visa requirements for the citizens of our two countries. Certainly, this will come along with new challenges, but also with new opportunities in our bilateral relations in the sphere of tourism, in terms of an increase of air flights between our countries, more than 850,000 people are flying between our countries, and the number of flights is also increasing. We see new opportunities for the development of this important sector. The Emirates host 3,000 Russian companies. The exchange between our countries has reached $3 billion. This is a significant increase, which consisted 27% compared to last year. 60,000 of Russian nationals reside in the United Arab Emirates. We appreciate the efforts of Russian government in participation in the event Russian Expo 2020. Russia is interested in the development, in transport development, which will be one of the major priorities of this event, and Russia will actively participate in Expo 2020. In the cultural sphere, we see a mutual interest between our two countries. Abu Dhabi hosted a folklore festival by Russian representatives and artists. Around 100 of Russians took part in these events, and we hope that these events will be more numerous in the future. We are also interested in the development of press publications and translations. We talked with my colleague, Mr. Lavrov. We discussed cooperation in space. We are happy that we have such cooperation. We hope that our ambitious goals will be fulfilled, including the launching of the first spaceman from the United Arab Emirates to the ISS. We are certain that our relations will develop in this sphere as well as in other spheres, and we are certain that that leaders of our two countries are interested in such development. Businessmen, along with businessmen and other people involved in economic ties, will seek to develop these relationships and to give them new dimensions. We're hoping to develop a new mechanism for the development of business relations. The IDEX exhibition was hosted recently. We welcome cooperation in the military sphere as well. The Emirates, together with Russia, take efforts to meet the challenges of today, such as drug trafficking, arms control, and counterterrorism. We are also fighting against intolerance. The Emirates are hosting a year of such a combat, and we are hoping that our cooperation with our colleagues will be fruitful in this regard. My dear friends, my colleague Sergei Lavrov, I welcome you in our country, and we appreciate your personal contribution to the development of bilateral relations.
Mr. Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, my friend, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, we've had a very good conversation today. We've assessed the current state of cooperation between Russia and the UAE. We have contacts in all kind of areas, the efforts are spearheaded by the leaders of our two countries, by Vladimir Putin and Mohammed Ali Abdullahian. During the visit of the prince to Russia last year, a historic document has been signed, which laid the foundation for further cooperation between our two countries in many areas. We have discussed in detail trade and economic issues, also investment, and we've discussed a number of joint projects in the areas such as hydrocarbons, nuclear energy, peaceful use of space. We have noted productive work of the Russian Direct Investment Fund and the Emirati Fund Abu Dhabi. They have already implemented a number of projects amounting to $2 billion and have agreed to bolster the efforts in this area. Our trade is increasing, as noted by my colleague. The efforts in this area are noted, and
Шейх Абдалла бен Заид, министр правопорядка Российской Федерации Денис Мантуров.
The military ties and military and industrial cooperation are actively developing. Last month, we've had a new military expo called IDEX, which was where Russia also represented its projects, which I hope will be implemented in the future. And as just said, we are happy with tourism as well as cultural and humanitarian ties. We are happy to see that these efforts are being supported by the two countries, and as you have noted, there is now visa-free travel between our two countries, a growth of the tourist stream into the UAE from Russia is welcome by the governments of both countries. On our part, we hope that the citizens of the UAE will also visit Russia more often, especially since many of them have very good memories of visiting the FIFA World Cup that took place in Russia last year. We have reaffirmed our invitation to our Emirati counterparts to take part in the Arabia Expo, in the next Arabia Expo, as well as in the Russian Arab Business Council. All of these events will take place in Moscow this year. As for the international agenda, as per tradition, we emphasize the situation in the Middle East and in Northern Africa. Both of our countries agree that we need to continue our fight against drug trafficking, illegal arms trading, and terrorism. We have similar approaches to these problems in the region. We are convinced that improving security in the region is impossible without overcoming all these crises and conflicts exclusively through diplomatic means based on international law. And both Russia and the UAE approach the issues in Syria, Libya, and Yemen from the same positions. We have seen very positive efforts from the UAE in Libya, and we can see that they are helping the Libyan citizens to overcome their long-standing crisis. We also have to mention the problem of the Palestine-Israel issue. We are still convinced that we need to resolve this crisis based on the legal framework created in order to, well, resolve this very old crisis. Russia is also interested in normalizing the situation in the Persian Gulf. We have proposed our own initiatives to our colleagues and friends that are aimed at improving cooperation in this important part of the world with the participation of all states involved. We'll continue to closely cooperate in this area, and I'm very thankful to my friends here, and I've invited my colleague for another visit to Russia as well. Thank you.
Let's start with our guests first. So I would ask one of our Russian colleagues to start. Yeah, please do.
Igor Zhdanov, Russia Today.
Igor Zhdanov, Russia Today. The U.S. is increasing its aggressive rhetoric against Russia. Well, under the pretext of defense against the Russian threat, the USA is trying to increase their presence, their military presence. The Russian side responded that it would deploy missiles that could threaten the whole of Europe. How would you comment this and the assertions that Russia would not let to pull itself into the new arms race? He also met the Syrian opposition and discussed the separation of the terrorists and opposition in Syria. How would you comment on that?
I don't believe you cited Antonov correctly, Ambassador Antonov. But our position with regard to how we're going to respond to the threat to our security that's constantly recreated by the U.S. This is something that has been explained by our President Vladimir Putin on numerous occasions. He has on many occasions said that we are not going to get involved in a new arms race. The arms program that has been implemented over the past years was aimed at modernizing our military. We now have new weapons and new systems that you are well aware and our Western colleagues are well aware of. We never declined any talks or negotiations that are aimed at improving security and in the world. But as you know, all of our proposals have been ignored. All of these proposals have remained just on paper. And we decided that we're not going to bother our Western counterparts with these proposals any longer. They know about our proposals, and once they're going to use them, we'll be open to cooperate. As for the missiles covering the entirety of Europe, I'd like to cite our president. He said that when the U.S. withdrew from the INF Treaty and at the same time started the official procedure of officially, legally withdrawing from the INF Treaty, Mr. Putin said that Russia is going to respond in kind. So we are basically also going to suspend the INF Treaty on our part. But after the 6 months that are required to withdraw from the INF Treaty are over, the INF will basically cease to exist. Mr. Putin also emphasized that if the U.S., after leaving the INF Treaty, start to deploy the missiles that have been prohibited by the INF Treaty in any part of the world, wherever these new missiles, American missiles, appear, we reserve the right to place our own missiles in the same region. This is not our choice. This is not what we want. This is what the U.S. decided to do. They probably believe they are probably very uncomfortable with the new world order being created, which is not based around the sole superpower, the new world order, which presupposes multiple powers that have to reach a balance of power. But As part of the SCO, as part of BRICS, we have been actively working to create this new framework. These organizations are based on mutual respect, not on one country dictating to all else how to act, which has been traditionally the Washington stance.
رضا البردي من صحيفة الرؤية سؤالي لمعالي معالي وزير الخارجية الروسي قبل فترة وصف رئيس
question is to Mr. Lavrov.
تدخل القوات التركية في سوريا بالعدوان.
President Assad said that the Turkish military coming into Syria is an act of aggression. Do you believe your opinion, what's your view of the presence of foreign troops in Syria? What's your view on the Turkish basically intervention into the Syrian affairs, considering that many reports and many analysis provided show that Turkey is gaining a foothold in Syria? As for the presence of foreign troops in any state, just from the position of international law, this can only be allowed if the government of the corresponding country allows that. We understand the concerns that Turkey must feel with regards to its security, considering historical and other circumstances. We are very pragmatic, and we want to find specific ways to resolve the Syrian crisis. We would like the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria to be restored, and this is why we started the Astana process together with the Islamic Republic of Iran and with the Turkish Republic. And this whole process at this moment is the only process that actually has led to some results, has yielded any results at all with regard to ceasefires, providing humanitarian aid to the population, and with regard to prisoners swaps, prisoners exchanges, helping refugees, looking for refugees, looking for those missing. And finally, we've helped actually launch a political process in accordance with resolution of the UN Security Council 2254, which involves our support of the Syrian people. We believe that the Syrian people need to determine their future themselves. So the Syrian government and the Syrian opposition both participate in the political process. This is the first time that that's happened. We were finally able to put these two groups to the same table. And both the Syrian president and the Turkish president supported the results of the Sochi meeting. We agreed on the 12 principles of the Syrian resolution, and we have adopted the idea of creating a constitutional committee, and we're currently still working together with our colleagues from the other states of the Astana process and with the UN to actually finally create the constitutional committee and launch it operations. The final goal of ours, of all of us, is to restore the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic in full. And taking into account the numerous factors that affect the Syrian crisis, taking into account the numerous foreign actors that are in some way involved in the process or interested in the process, we know that this is not going to be very quick, but we are determined to move in this direction. Our Turkish friends agree with us, and the Syrians agree with us. And excuse me, I haven't answered your, well, the other question, which the question of the first journalist, whether we've discussed the issue of separating the armed opposition and Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Nusra front. Yesterday, at the meeting, no, we haven't discussed this meeting, this issue yesterday. We are discussing it primarily with the Syrian government and the Syrian opposition and the Turkish Republic. And together with our Syrian and Turkish colleagues, we are implementing practical steps to achieve a solution and to reach the decision.
I want to pick one of your Russian colleagues.
I think they're tired. They look tired.
The gentleman in the front, you represent Russian media, right? Okay.
Кирилл Котиков, французская редакция Russia
Today. Кирилл Котиков, RT France. Вчера США заявил. Сергей Викторович, the USA yesterday said that it would impose sanctions on any state to support Nicolas Maduro. How would you comment on that?
Frankly speaking, I haven't heard about that. I've been traveling through the region. I'm trying to keep track of what's happening, but, you know, tracking everything, every statement, arrogant statement by Washington, I don't have enough time to do that, and I, frankly speaking, I can't be bothered to do that. But if the statement was made that anyone who supports the legitimate president will be sanctioned, well, this only means that American diplomacy is losing its ability to actually use diplomatic means and are reverting back to a language that was never one of diplomacy. And this is, of course, unacceptable.
We'll take the last question, ladies and gentlemen. So, okay, so why don't we pick one of the UAE colleagues here, please?
شكرا طويل العمر. سؤالي الأول يعني بعد عودة فتح
My first question, the UAE embassy is now open in Damascus. Is it the time to return Syria to the League of Arab Nations, or is it premature now? Well, undoubtedly, it's very important to analyze the current developments and the developments of the recent years as well. What decisions were made and how they influenced the fate of Syria and its people. We in the Emirates want the League of Arab Nations to play its role in the Syrian problem, in seeking solution to that problem. They should seek to restore stability and security in this country. It goes without saying that we did not see eye to eye to the foreign policy of Damascus. But now we see the increasing of influence of Turkey and Iran and the diminishing of the role of the League of Arab Nations. We are not going to accept that, and that is why we are going to cooperate with Russia and others in order to find a solution to this crisis and to see what to do next. How do we achieve? How do we make sure that Syria remains a part of the region? And unfortunately, we see little chances of that. We decided to reopen our embassy in Damascus in order to change the course of events. As for the reinstating Syria in the League of Arab Nations, it depends on the will of other nations, not just ours. And we hope that the role of Syria and the Arab people in Syria is going to increase and bring new hope that the situation will be settled. But now we are far from that. But we are still hoping for success. Thank you. And thanks again to my colleague, my friend, for such a useful visit. Tomorrow he will meet Mohammed bin Said. They will discuss a wide range of issues, including those we discussed today. They will also touch the regional and global problems. I am very, very happy with how our relations are developing. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Can socialism bring about a radiant future? A growing number of voters seem to think so. What do these voters and some members of Congress mean by socialism? Free stuff for all? The state controlling the means of production? No borders? Why are so many falling out of love with capitalism? Crosstalking Socialism. I'm joined by my guest Steve Maltzberg in New York. He's a conservative political commentator. And in Washington, we have Ivan Elin. He is the senior fellow at the Independent Institute and author of the forthcoming book, War and the Rogue Presidency. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime, and I always appreciate it. Steve, let me go to you first here. I mean, poll after poll indicate that there's a growing appreciation, even wanting, of something that's called socialism. Now, at the outset, I'm not particularly sure they know what socialism is, okay? Maybe, like I said in my introduction, they just want free stuff. They want free education. They want open borders. They want free medical care. They want everything, which I find really bizarre. If you are an open border person and you want to have this, what they call socialism, well, then I guess most of the world is going to pack up their bags and move to the United States, where they'll have this radiant future. And I'm using that term, obviously, for a reason, because that was what the Soviet Union tried to create and did not. What do you think accounts for this attraction, this allure of socialism? Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I think, you know, Donald Trump said in his State of the Union, America will never become a socialist nation. There is an attraction, especially when you take one of the ingredients or promises that the socialists are making, free, you know, health care, Medicare for all, as they call it. And that gets overwhelming support. But when you rephrase the question and let people know, hey, you're going to have an increase, severe increase in taxes to pay for it, the support goes down. hey, you're not going to be able to choose your doctor, keep your doctor, keep your insurance or that you currently have, the support goes way down again. So you were right on target. People don't know what it entails. They like the concept of free, but again, not everybody likes the concept of free. I wouldn't say a majority of Americans would want socialism. I would say there's a hardcore leftist base that's on board with this, and college students, yeah, and people who aren't doing as well, and you know, and their appeal, the appeal of free stuff is appealing.
You know, I have the same question to you. And obviously, you know, if you look at these poll numbers, it's the millennials that are seem to be attracted by this. And I suppose you could look at the fact that we have a younger generation now that are not doing better than their parents. This is an unprecedented moment in American history, if you take with the exception of the Great Depression. But, you know, there's a lot of aspiring people that are saying that, you know, the current economy isn't working for them and probably won't work for them either. Do you think that's one of the reasons for the allure of socialism as they understand it anyway? Go ahead, Ivan in Washington.
Yes, well, capitalism has cycles, and whenever there's a recession or a depression, I mean, we saw it in the 1930s when the government increased a lot. All these programs, FDR didn't have a rhyme or reason. He was just throwing spaghetti at the wall, hoping something would work or stick. Lyndon Johnson did the same thing in the Great Society, although he had a better economy when he did it. But I think my own view is that this talk of socialism, which is really democratic socialism, it's not hardcore socialism. Socialism, by definition, is nationalizing of industries. Yeah. And we had some of that under the Bush administration, the Obama administration, because of the last recession in 2007, 2008. And I think that's probably what triggered this movement, because I think a lot of people saw that the capitalist system was faltering because it was such a severe worldwide recession. And it was actually caused by the government. But of course, yeah, people don't see that. They say that, well, the government causes a problem. Well, we need more government intervention. You know, we had the financial regulations that were put in. We had the socialism. Bush nationalized AIG insurance company. Obama, at least for a while, nationalized the car companies. That's true socialism. Now, Bernie Sanders, the first indication was this was in the last campaign in 2016 when Bernie Sanders did not disavow the socialist label. But he's not really a true socialist. He's a democratic socialist, which means free stuff. It's not so much nationalization of industries, although you can say that Medicare for all is nationalization of health insurance industry, but that's sort of a limited nationalization. Usually it's regulation of business.
Yeah, but hold on, you guys. We've been using the term free stuff, and Steve, I want you to react to it. Nothing is free, okay? I mean, you're going to give up a lot for the free stuff, all right? And that's what I worry about. I mean, this Green New Deal, I mean, it's a ridiculous document. I mean, it wasn't written by experts, let's put it that way. It was written by poets that had read Marx, okay? But what I worry about, and it's important that we're talking about what socialism is here, but the Green New Deal essentially is the nationalization of the entire economy. And if you look at Kamala Harris and other people like that, when they, you know, healthcare for all, they're talking about outlawing private insurance. I mean, that's why we're making this program here, because words do have meaning. And I tell everyone that I have a conversation on this topic is that I lived in Eastern Europe, communist Eastern Europe, for many years in the 1980s. So I got a firsthand taste of what it's like. And there weren't any cappuccinos and there weren't any Birkenstocks, okay? They were actually very poor places that were more or less stagnant. Okay, no dynamism, and this is what really bothers me. Capitalism has a lot of problems, but I would call that the financialization of capitalism, and that's a different issue. Go ahead, Steve.
No, I was going to say, you know, I don't think the people who are now, with all due respect to our other guests, and he's right, but I don't think the people who are involved in this now, who are embracing socialism now and this free stuff, are thinking back to, you know, what the Bush administration did with the auto industry and the banking industry, blah, blah, blah. They don't care about that. They do view corporations as evil. And they drove Amazon out of their deal in New York, and they applauded each other. They slapped each other on the back. They took over 25,000 jobs away from New York and a bustling benefits to the economy. And they said, yeah, we got that evil corporation out of here. They want to nationalize. They don't want people to own their own businesses. They don't want corporations to make profits. That's all part of this. Be aware of that. It's not just free stuff. It's taking everything away from the corporations who are evil. So it's very frightening. And, you know, you talk about how the Green New Deal was written. Donald Trump calls it a poorly written high school term paper. And I think he's right, and you're correct as well.
You know, Ivan, I mean, if you look at these grandiose plans, I mean, I always am very worried about the size of these programs here and the bureaucratization of it. And I think it would erode our rights, because it seems to me the kind of things people are talking about are they're telling us that we'll have far fewer choices to make. And I think that's an important part of our culture and civic nature, is to be able to have choices. It seemed to me they want to limit these choices. And I'm not convinced that these people, I mean, look at the Great Society. I mean, the Great Society had so much goodwill. I believe that. And they make great Hollywood films about it, you know. But most of it didn't work, okay? And you created cyclical poverty. I mean, look at what happened to the black family as a result of the Great Society. It was a disaster. And we're all living with that today. So good intentions, that's when I look for the door. Ivan, go ahead in Washington.
Yeah, I think a lot of the programs don't work, and I think the New Deal didn't cure the Depression. I think certainly the War on Poverty didn't do that. Anytime any government does a war on something, poverty, yeah, drugs, whatever, it usually doesn't work. It's usually counterproductive, and they waste a lot of money and distort the market. And I think, you know, what they should do if they're, you know, if you take a more Friedman-esque approach to these things, you should let the market work, and then if you don't like the market, then you can give people money and let them spend it in the market rather than creating all these bureaucratic programs. But you know, some people would even object to that. But of course, we're nowhere near Venezuela or you know, some of these other places like Cuba or you know, the true socialist or communist countries. But I think certainly this is a path we don't want to go on. And I think right now this is confined primarily to the left wing of the Democratic Party, but it could seep out into the national discourse, and it may during the 2020 campaign.
We're going to talk about it in the second half here. Right before we go to the break here, Steve, one of the things I keep coming across is that, well, they want the Scandinavian model. Well, again, they're just lazy, and they repeat what they hear on CNN and MSNBC. Look at the economies in Scandinavia. They're not socialist in that sense. As a matter of fact, they're very compassionate capitalists. I mean, the government does provide vouchers for families where they can decide what school they go to, okay? They pay a lot of taxes. These are much smaller economies, and they have a built-in work ethic. So, I mean, it's not what they think it is, okay? Again, this is just dreaming instead of really cracking the books and trying to figure out how something works, because I'm open to good ideas. I'm not ideologically closed like these people are. Last 30 seconds before we go to the break. Steve.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. They try to dress it up as best they can and give, you know, these kinds of examples that don't hold water when you look into them. And their answers don't hold water. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, who's spearheading this new Green Deal and the socialism movement here.
The boss.
When she's asked for specifics, she says, specifics? Who needs specifics?
Who needs,
you know,
facts?
We have 12 years or the world's going to go, we're dead. So forget money. Who cares?
The interview.
She said, we'll print more money.
No, I love the interview when she didn't care about facts here. All right, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on socialism. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Washington here. You mentioned something that was really kind of interesting to me. You talked about Bernie Sanders in 2016, and now we have seen the discourse, the rhetoric go further to the left here. He was considered pretty lefty in 2016, and that attracted a lot of attention and a lot of support, okay? And I think, unfortunately, the nomination was stolen from him by the Clinton clan here. We could have had a much more interesting, robust debate instead of talking about her damn emails all the time. But Ivan, when you look at Bernie Sanders now, I mean, he looks quite moderate. Is it really the Trump effect, the Trump derangement syndrome that has captured the left? I mean, on any single issue, virtually, they have to be against Trump. So Trump is against socialism, so we must be for it. I mean, this is kind of a childish reductionism, but it seems to be in play. Go ahead in Washington.
Well, I think, certainly there is a reaction to Trump. But, Bernie Sanders, many of these ideas originated with his campaign. I mean, they didn't originate, but he popularized them in 2016. And I think they've gone beyond that. I also see some parallels with the populism on the right, because part of it's populist as well as socialist. It is that, we've got to go against the establishment.
Yeah.
And in this case, they're coming from the left rather than the right. And a lot of these anti-market policies are also exhibited by Trump. To some degree, he's more pro-business, but being pro-business and pro-market are much different. And so you see populism on both the right and the left. The left is certainly reacting to Trump, some of Trump's policies as well.
You know, Steve, OAC now the leader of the Democratic Party? I mean, it seems to me that, when she changes the tune, everybody dances, okay? I mean, I know that this is a ploy about, Fox News adores her because they see the Democrats committing political suicide over her. I mean, she's cute, she's adorable, but she's as dumb as a doorknob, okay? But she's really being talked up. But she's being talked up, but now it's not so funny, because what they're doing is that she's the new Trump. She's the new magnet of attention, where they think that, the people will sneer at her. She looks great. She dresses great. She's, cooking, doing, on social media, and she's the boss and all that. I mean, she's perfect for social media and television, but she is affecting the agenda, and the Fox News types are fueling her on, and I'm not sure that's a pretty good idea, because that's what CNN and MSNBC did to Trump. Go ahead, Steve.
I post a lot of stories about her, especially lately, her campaign manager. There's a violation that was filed for breaking the law when it came to how her money was handled, that she doesn't live where she's claimed she lived, all kinds of inconsistencies, that she takes Uber and cab service when the subway is two blocks away, when, of course, she's the big green person. So I post all that, and people say back to me, stop talking about her. Ignore her. Let her go away. But she's not going to go away one way or another. I do think she has amazing influence in the Democratic Party. And I think we're seeing it with some of the anti-Semitism accusations against fellow freshman congressmen, one in particular, Congressman Omar. And AOC came out in defense of her. And the leadership of the Democratic Party seemingly backed down and said, we're not going to take Omar off any committees. We're going to have a watered down resolution. I don't know why she has all this pull. She won in a district where hardly anybody came out to vote in that particular election. She won fair and square, but nobody came out to vote. And now you would think she won the most popular election ever. I don't know. But she should not be ignored. She cannot be ignored. As dumb as she is, as out there as she is, as crazy as she is, she will have followers.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, let me just stay with you for a second here, Steve. But I mean, on the plus side of the ledger, I enjoy watching their identity politics cave in on itself. That's a really good indication that it is right now. Ivan, let me go back to you in Washington. this is creating rifts within the Democratic Party. And of course, the GOP, this loves this here. I mean, how are they going to be able to bring this rift to an end? Because there's going to be the particularly with Bernie Sanders, if he's not given a fair shot, they're going to say they were cheated again. And those that voted for Trump in the end as a revenge vote, this might happen again. People are going to feel that their vote didn't count. I mean, I think the Democrats, as crazy as they are, and I mean, this is a three-ring circus with these candidates out there, Beto or Beto or whatever his name is, and then, you've got Spartacus, and you've got Pocahontas out there. I mean, this is entertaining as can be. But ideologically speaking, it's going to be tough to keep their coalition together. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah, I think the danger for the Democrats is that they get pulled so far to the left. And some people like AOC, who are not even running, are helping to pull them there, and some of the other freshmen as well. But they have the same problem, I think, as the Republicans had in the last election, and that is they have a lot of candidates and there's a lot of different views. And of course, on the Democratic side, they're to the left of the electorate. And in the Republican Party in 2016, it was to the right of the electorate. But, it depends on who the Democrats put up. But it's also the next election, as most presidential elections, unfortunately for Trump, I think, are a referendum on the current administration. So it ought to be very interesting. I'm not saying a really far left candidate could beat Trump, but if the Democrats also want to get rid of Trump, so they may try to muzzle these people. Pelosi has already tried to muzzle AOC, and as you point out, sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. She has a lot of charisma. She knows how to work social media. She's very telegenic. And, of course, she doesn't know anything, as you point out, but that doesn't stop people on both sides from getting on TV. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the election.
Yeah, Steve, if you look what happened prior to the Civil War, you had the Whig Party. It was a dominant party. And in a short number of years, you had the emergence of the Republican Party because you had a crisis in the country. We had Herbert Hoover was not reelected because of the Great Depression. What I'm getting at here is that there are these moments in time where people are willing to experiment. And I'm wondering if the Democrats are going to go out on the limb here, because they seem all intimidated. Again, their identity politics crushes their intellectual abilities. They all stand in fear. I saw how many congressmen, seasoned folks, standing around OAC when she's got that green document there, and it was like she was holding Mao's red book, and they're all nodding their heads. I mean, what are you guys doing? I mean, you're just, you're fighting over the seating order on top of the Titanic. I mean, this is why I think that, Trump, not because he's particularly been effective as president, because I don't think he has been, but he's just going to let his opponents get into a circular firing squad. Steve.
They are the gift that keeps on giving. You're absolutely right. Not to mention, we haven't even talked because it doesn't fit in, but the stance on abortion, the radical stance on abortion that party has. I mean, Trump could just pick off topic after topic after topic. And there's such a different party. Bill Clinton, when Hillary was running, and that was 4 years ago, had to apologize for welfare reform, for don't ask, don't tell, for the crime bill. He had to apologize for his biggest achievements. They are an unrecognizable party. And, they're talking about, well, if Biden gets in, and he'll have to apologize for things that happened under Obama. That's how far off the left cliff they've gone in such a short amount of time.
It was the blue wall and other states that made the difference the last time. Could we see the same thing happen again? Because I'm pretty sure the Democrats are going to go to Michigan and Minnesota and elsewhere. I'm pretty sure they're going to go this time. Okay. I mean, we've all been in one form or another kind of made light of these ridiculous ideas on the left here. But how do you think the heartland sees it? Because, I think that I'm from the Midwest. Those are my origins. Okay. Unfortunately, I spent a lot of time in California, but I did survive the corrupting element there. I don't see socialism as being attractive at all. I think they just want results and actually less government. This is agricultural congressional districts. They certainly want government help when it's necessary, but not over regulation. And I don't think they want to become the Ministry of Agriculture in the future administration of AOC. Go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I'm originally from Iowa, and the people there's always been a resistance to socialism and radical labor unions throughout American history, and I think the resistance is still there to some extent. Although with the new millennial and Gen Z people, it's less in stone. And I think one of the reasons, as I pointed out, was the deep recession that we had a while back and that they've grown up under. And so this is probably one of the factors that's pushing that. But I think certainly there's going to be all those states are a little older up there than other states. And so I think there's plenty of reserve that could go Trump's way in those three states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Now, his numbers aren't very good there now, but, you know, it's almost two years before the election, so it's a lot of time to recalibrate there. But, you know, he could conceivably win the same way. His problem is that he won about the only way he could win last time, and he's got to pretty much replicate that the next time.
30 seconds, Steve. Close our program out.
Well, the good news is, you know, everybody says Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million votes. If you take away New York and California, which she won by 6 million, Donald Trump won the other 48 states by 3 million. So that's an optimistic note to end on if you're rooting for Donald Trump again. And he's going to motivate the left is going to motivate people who didn't even vote in the first place to come out and vote for Trump time around.
I think the turnout will be huge, and we got plenty of time. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Washington. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.